Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Christine Carlson, and she will be leading a Bible study dealing with Romans and God's work. So let's listen in on Christine Carlson.
I'm from Northfield, Minnesota, and I live there with my husband and three children, and am a student in a doctoral program in New Testament at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. I'm also a pastor. So those are some of the things about me for those of you to whom I'm new, but I'm thrilled that you're here. I said one day already, I think, that Bible study is about my favorite thing in the world to do. So I am really looking forward to our hour together now. The series that we're looking at this week is Community Issues in Romans. And so our focus is the book of Romans, and what I've done is to pull out issues that I think are important and interesting for community life. We live here at Holden in community all the time, and so I guess that was one of the reasons that compelled me to think about community issues as a place to focus for the week. But we're also members of many other communities as we head on home, congregations, families, towns, cities, country. We have many communities that we're members of. So I hope the issues that we're looking at this week are helpful to you as you live your life. We've looked already at slavery, freedom, and speech was our first day's topic. Then we looked at sin, wrath, and righteousness. And today we're going to be looking at God's work. That's our main theme for our study today. A friend was teasing me that I should really call this study Roman in Romans. That's sort of what it feels like, maybe. So let's roam a little bit. I put the outline of Romans up on the board as I did yesterday again. For those of you who are new, I thought that it would give you a skeleton sense of the letter. And I won't take a lot of time to go through it again because I did that yesterday. But just briefly, if you want to follow through in your Bibles, Paul begins with a salutation, identifying himself and the people to whom he's writing down in verse 7. He doesn't have a thanksgiving in Galatians, and so that tells you right away what's going on here, that he's mad at the Galatians. He's not thanking God for them. So, but there is one in Romans, and Paul expresses a desire to visit them. Then the theme of the letter is expressed in verses 16 to 17, that the gospel is the power for salvation and to reveal God's righteousness. Then, the material that we looked at yesterday, chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 20, the big subject, sin, and we spent yesterday focusing on that. Then, the bulk of the letter is halfway through chapter 3, verse 21 through 11:36, and Monday's topic on slavery, this is not writing very well, let's try another one. Slavery fit in there. Our subject today, God's work, looks at that material, as does our topic. We don't have the Romans Bible study tomorrow. We have text study at this hour. But then on Friday, we'll be looking at the creation. After that big section on how God saves all from sin, Paul considers then the implications of God's salvation for our community life together. So Paul gets into some ethical issues, and we'll look at those on Saturday as we consider the neighbor. And then Paul ends the book, chapter 15, starting in verse 14, going through the end of chapter 16, with his own plans, his travel plans, sort of, where he'd like to go and who he'd like to see. And then chapter 16 is full of greetings. There was a question that came up yesterday about the audience of the letter to the Romans. Is it a letter written primarily to men? Are women included in this letter? This is a very interesting topic that some biblical scholars are spending a lot of time working on these days. Who's the audience of the books in the Bible? And how do these books address and include men? How do they address and include women? I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but since the issue came up, I want to take a look at chapter 16. So let's turn to that and see what we find there that will help us think about the audience of this letter. I said in the salutation part, it begins, "Paul, to all the beloved in Rome." So that's the first indication for us about who this letter is addressed to all the beloved. Well, who are they? Are all the beloved all men? Do they include women? That was the question that came up yesterday. Chapter 16 then, as I said, is a chapter full of greetings that Paul is sending. And this is not unusual. I spent the spring reading a lot of letters, Greco-Roman letters, written at the time of Paul. And people often end with, "Greet your daughter. Greet Olivia, greet Demetrius, and greet Apollos." That was we don't do that necessarily as we write letters today, but that was part of the style of letter writing of Paul's time. So this is very typical. I never read quite such an extensive list of greetings, though. Paul gets carried away, and that's one of the lovable things about him, I think. The first one that he asks to be greeted, though, is in chapter 16, verse 1. "I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon," that word can also be translated minister, "of the church at Cenchreae." So the first person that Paul identifies here in the greetings is Phoebe. And it's interesting, one other thing about Phoebe that I read just last night as I was fussing around about this is that the scholars think that Phoebe was maybe the carrier of the letter. We take letter writing so much for granted in our culture. You write a letter, slap a 29-cent stamp on an envelope, and drop it in the mailbox. And you're pretty confident that in 3 days, maybe 5 days, it will get where you sent it. Maybe even the next day, if it's close by or the mail service is working really well. In Paul's day, there was no postal system for moving letters around to people. Rich people had a slave, maybe a couple slaves, whose singular job was to be the letter carrier. There's a Greek word that identifies them and names their task. That's all they did in the household of a wealthy person. But this meant perhaps traveling across the Mediterranean Ocean, maybe across a desert, climbing mountains to deliver the letter. I mean, it was no easy task and was, in some cases, probably a full-time job for several slaves. There also was no dependability about letters getting where they were sent. I was reading last night that Augustine of Hippo, who's a famous person of the church, living in North Africa, wrote a letter to Jerome, another famous person in the church, who was in Bethlehem, and it took 9 years for that letter to get there. I'd never heard that before. It finally did get there. But it's just so different from our own letter writing sense. At the early Bible study today, there was a man who shared a story about a man living in California who he knows, whose daughter is working as a missionary in the Cameroons. And when she writes him a letter, it sometimes takes 6, 8, 10 weeks for this letter to get from the Cameroon to California. But when a letter can come more quickly is when someone is visiting in the Cameroon. And they say, they'll be there, and then they'll say, "Oh, I'm leaving tomorrow." So everybody runs home and writes letters to friends in the States, and then that person carries the letters back to wherever in the States they are and puts them in the mail, and then they get them in 3 to 5 days. So that's I think, is as close as we can get to a contemporary example of the situation of letter writing in Paul's time, how undependable it was. But Phoebe, people think, was the carrier of the letter. Then Paul goes on in verse 3. "Greet Prisca and Aquila." We've had Phoebe, now we have a man and wife. We think this is a husband and wife team, a man and a woman. "Prisca and Aquila, who work with me in Christ Jesus, and who risk their necks for my life," Paul says. Then he says, "Greet also the church in their house." And this gives us a bit of a picture. People were asking, how did people get these letters? And when they were received, how did people hear them or read them or have access to them? And this gives us a bit of a picture of how it worked in a place like Rome, that there were house churches with people who were leaders of them. Prisca and Aquila, for instance, were leaders of a house church. And then when a letter came from someone like Paul, all these house churches would gather together, maybe in a place like this. And someone, maybe like me, would sit here and read you the letter. That's how you would encounter Paul's letter to the Romans. So we get a sense of that. Paul goes on in verse 5, "Greet my beloved Epaphras, the first convert in Asia." And then 6 is interesting. "Greet Mary, who has worked very hard among you." As this list goes on, you're getting a sense, I hope, of the involvement of men and women in this very early Christian community. And I hope that that gives you a sense of the kind of audience Paul was writing to. I'm real confident that it included women as well as men as we continue down the list. In verse 7, there's Junia, Andronicus and Junia. There's lots of debate about whether that should be Julia or Junia or Junius. Is that a man or a woman? Lots of debate about that. But then later on in verse 13, "Greet Rufus and greet his mother," a mother to me also. Down in verse 15, "Greet Philologus, Julia, Nereus, and his sister." So we have a very mixed audience that we find here in the book of Romans. One other thing, this is totally beside the point, but verse 22 is interesting as we consider letter writing again. We read in verse 22, "I, Tertius, the writer of this letter, greet you in the Lord." This letter was not written by Paul. It was dictated by Paul to a professional writer, Tertius. And so he's the one then who slips in his own greetings, as Paul didn't tell him to do that, but as he's writing the letter. And if you want to, you can turn to the end of the first letter to the Corinthians, where you get the sense of how letters were written again. In 1 Corinthians 16, this letter also was written out, transcribed by someone other than Paul. And then finally in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 21, we find Paul saying this, "I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand." You know, he's taken the letter out of the hands of the professional scribe, and now Paul is writing just a few words tacked on at the end. So that doesn't have much to do with anything, but it gives you another sense of letter writing in Paul's time and how different it was from our own letter writing now. All right, well, let's go on then to look at the topic for today. And what I want to focus on is God's work, the work of God, as Paul talks about it in Romans. And I've actually added a couple words to the theme for the day. We'll be talking about God's work with and witness. For the last, all the days I've been here, I've had 3 words in the title, so I didn't think, want you to think I was boring or stuck in a rut. So now I have 4. God's work with and witness. And we'll get to the end part of it in a few minutes. I want to talk first about God's work. Yesterday, we were looking at the first 3 chapters of the letter to the Romans and talking about how Paul is exploring and relentlessly exploring our human sinfulness. For 3 chapters, we just kept spiraling around, and it felt like we were spiraling down into the depths of human sin. And if you'll look with me at the end of chapter 3, we didn't read these verses yesterday, but I wanted to point out to you again the technique of Paul as he's exploring these issues. He talks in his own voice for three chapters about human sin, human evil, this dark human nature that he's depicting. And then in chapter 3, starting in verse 10, Paul turns to the scriptures, the holy scriptures of the Old Testament, for support for his argument. In a way saying to the people, if you don't believe me about this, here's what your holy scripture says. And let's see what he's done. What he's done is to take verses from six Psalms and a passage from Isaiah and patch them together to make a collage. And he writes, there is no one who is righteous, not even one. There is no one who has understanding. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. There is no one who shows kindness. There is not even one. You hear this echoing. Paul's developed this theme in his own words. And now here is scripture. Holy scripture supporting this point. All have sinned. All have rebelled against God. There is not even one who hasn't. That's the sense that we get then in chapter 3 up to verse 20. And then we talked yesterday about the wonder of verse 21 that Paul drops into the midst of this very deep and dark picture of human sin. Romans 3 verse 21. But now, Paul writes, apart from law, the righteousness of God has been disclosed. Where did this come from, this righteousness of God? Certainly not from anything that any of us have done. All we've been sitting around for three chapters doing is getting more and more sinful. And that's been our work. And into the midst of that, Paul drops this miracle of God's righteousness. Can you feel the sheer grace of that, the sheer gift of it, as Paul writes, and as it actually is for us? This gift from God. Reading on into verse 22, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. I'd like to consider just briefly this sense of the righteousness of God that Paul introduces here in 21 and then develops. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. Going on into verse 26 of this third chapter, Paul continues, it was to prove at the present time that God is righteous and that God justifies the one who has faith in Jesus. The argument that Paul is making is that God was faithful in Jesus Christ. God delivered Jesus from death and from the burden of sin to life. And so just as God was faithful to Jesus Christ, so God will be faithful to each of you. That's the argument that Paul is making here in the third chapter, developing this notion of the righteousness of God. We can depend on God to treat us rightly because Jesus and God's treatment of Jesus is our testimony to the way God works. And Paul says, this is the work of God on our behalf. It's a gift, and it comes here as it comes in the letter, out of nowhere, through no action on our part. This is a theme in the letter to the Romans, then, that I'd like to explore a bit today. This surprising, unexpected, even shocking way that God works in our lives and in us. This first example that we find is here in chapter 3, verse 21. How does God work? In us sinful human beings. I think this is something that we can take for granted. And Paul wants us to catch the surprise of that, the shock of that. There's another unexpected place, and there are lots of passages we could look at in Romans, but I've chosen three. The next one is in chapter 6, and this again gets back to material that we were looking at yesterday. Chapter 6, verse 12. And we talked yesterday about this three-word members And afterwards at coffee, I realized that I hadn't clarified that the meaning of this word well enough. It's from a Greek word, melee. And there was confusion yesterday. I think, did it mean members of the community, you know, members of a group, or did it mean members of the body? And that's the meaning of this, members of the body. It's a member, a body part, a limb. That's the meaning of this members word that Paul is using here in chapter 6. So let's read 12 and 13 and see again a surprising, shocking way that God works for righteousness. Paul writes, "Therefore, do not let sin exercise dominion in your mortal bodies to make you obey their passions. No longer present your members to sin as instruments of wickedness, but present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and present your members to God as instruments of righteousness." Here the sense of members is our sexual parts. You can gather that from the context that's set in verse 12. Therefore, do not let sin exercise dominion in your mortal bodies to make you obey their passions. And the sense that Paul is saying is that at one time we presented our sexual parts for wickedness and for sin. But Paul is saying, and this will echo a point I was wanting to make yesterday, that if we see ourselves primarily as sexual beings, we will be consumed by our own obsession with sexuality. We will be consumed by our lusts and our sexual parts. Paul is saying, there are more important things about you than that. And the most important thing in this passage, he says, is that you are one who has been brought from death to life. That's the most important thing about you. And by the grace of God, seeing yourself that way, sexual parts, he goes on, can be instruments of righteousness. This is a very surprising passage for me to discover. And it is so interesting, I think, because Paul does not succumb to the sense that you find so much in literature of his time, that the mind is good and the body is bad, that thinking is good and sexuality is bad. He's saying there's sex is redeemed, our sexual parts, our sexuality is redeemed and can even be an instrument for righteousness if we are seeing ourselves by the grace of God as one whom God has delivered from death to life. That's a real shocking, surprising way to see God working. But again, that's another way that we see in the book of Romans. The third way that I'd like to spend the bulk of our time now exploring is in Romans 8. And this is the chapter that we'll be spending today and Friday in. This is about my favorite material in the book of Romans. It's such a rich and climactic and wonderful chapter in this book. And today what I'd like to look at in chapter 8 is another surprising way that God's work is played out. A surprising way where we find God at work. I'm a little nervous about doing this because it's what I want to show you next is an argument that depends on the Greek. And I have struggled for 3 days whether I should try this out or not. I tried it at the first session in the early Bible study, and it was very exciting. So I hope that it will be somewhat successful, or as successful here with you. What I want to say is that what we find in Romans 8 is that God's work is revealed in a little Greek word, S-Y-N. And when we say it, it sounds like sin. So that's a problem. I don't want us associating this with sin. And I've hesitated to pursue this topic with you because it, as I said, depends so much on knowledge of Greek. And I worry about that with you. But the challenge to me, I think, as a teacher, is to try to translate this Greek word into English in a way that will help you see the wonderful way it works in Greek in this passage. So that's my challenge. What I need from you is a little patience while I put this up on the board so you can see it. We'll work through it slowly, and I hope that it will be as fascinating and important to you as it has been to me since I discovered it. The other thing that I thought this might do that would be really helpful for you is to see the challenges of translation. This is a Greek text that we're working with, and we are always reading it in English. And I'm utterly committed to people being able to read the English text and receiving rich words of God from that. I'm utterly committed to that. But there are times, working with an English text, when we miss things that are there in the Greek, because translating into English loses it. And this is one of the cases that will perhaps give you a sense of the struggle in translating the Bible and what we might miss once in a while because we are working with an English text and not with the Greek. So let's go on and see what we can do here. This word in Greek means whip. That's where the width and the whiteness in my title come from. Another way that I have chosen to translate it that gets as close to it in English, I think, as we can, is ko. You know how we add ko to the beginning of words? A co-worker. That gives a sense. And that's the word that I will use as I translate all these Greek occurrences of this word. The sense is doing or being together. That's the sense in Greek that I will try to communicate with you then in this chapter. The other thing I want to say about this word is that it appears in chapter 8 in Romans, as I claimed. Before this, this word in throughout seven chapters appears 9 times. It's scattered around just 9 occurrences in 7 chapters. Then, when we get to the 8th chapter of Romans, starting in verse, I should know this, I think it's starting in verse 16. Now, starting in verse 16, Romans 8, 16, it appears for the first time in the 8th chapter. And in the next 17 verses, we have 10 occurrences of this little word, sin. So 10 times in 17 verses. And it was in reading the Greek text and noticing this cluster of all these sins that I thought, why are they here? What's this cluster of these little words doing? What's Paul up to? And so that's what piqued my curiosity, and that's what I will try to communicate to you. So let's work through the beginning of chapter 8 to set ourselves up to be ready to hear this, starting in verse 16, and see what Paul's up to. In chapter 8, if Paul, for the first time, introduces this barrage of this little word, son, Paul also introduces the Spirit. The Spirit has hardly occurred in the letter to the Romans, but now the Spirit becomes an active character in Paul's letter. And let's see what the Spirit is up to here. In verse 2 of chapter 8, for the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death. It's the Spirit working who has delivered us from these curses that we've struggled under, law, sin, and death. Going on into verse 4, so that the just requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Now our choice is to walk according to the Spirit who has been given to us. Then going down into verse 10, we read, "But if Christ is in you, though the body is dead because of sin, the spirit is life because of righteousness." Though we live in these bodies that are going to die, the spirit is what brings us life and God's righteousness, Paul is claiming. Then going on into verse 14, I'm just skipping over material to try to develop this a bit for you. We find again that passage that we looked at in on Monday, and where in verse 14, we are named children of God. "For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God." And we talked on Monday about how for 7.5 chapters, the word that described us was slave. Slave to sin and slave to God, finally. And now we talked about next for us here in chapter 8, where a new word is introduced, the word children. And it's the Spirit of God that's involved in our becoming children of God. The Spirit plays that role. And the other thing that as children of God we have is speech. We can talk. This is the first time we talk in the book of Romans. We've been silent for 7.5 chapters, and we cry, "Abba." It's at this point, after we cry, "Abba," that this little word, "son," enters Paul's vocabulary. Let's look at these occurrences next. I'll just take our English Bibles and I'll work through and show you where these words occur. The first one, as I said, occurs in 8:16. And my English translation says, "It is that very Spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God." And the way I prefer to translate that now to communicate this sense to you is, it is that very Spirit co-witnessing with our spirit. That's the first instance, co-witnessing. Going on into verse 17, there are three in this little verse. Reading on, "And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ." The way I prefer to translate that is co-heirs, because that's where the son word appears in Greek again. We are co-heirs with Christ. Reading on, "If in fact we suffer with him," that word in Greek is co-suffer. "If in fact we co-suffer with Christ." "So that we may also be co-glorified with him," is the sense in the Greek. So do you see how these co's are starting to mount up visually and as we hear? Then going on, the next one that we encounter is in verse 22 of chapter 8. And this really gives you the sense. In these first four examples, we've had words like with and together and stuff like that that communicates the sense. But here in verse 22, you can see how the English translation completely obscures the sense of witness. My text reads, "We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now." And in Greek, we should read instead, "We know that the whole creation has been co-groaning." It's the first instance of that. And then what my Bible says, "We have been co-groaning in labor pains." In the Greek, it's another verb, and it's co-laboring. We have been co-groaning and co-laboring in childbirth together. That's the sense that we get in verse 22. Co-groaning, co-laboring. Then moving on, the next one we find is in verse 26. And this is talking about the work of the Spirit again. My text says, Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. So we miss entirely this meaning. Likewise, the Spirit co-helps us in our weakness, is the sense in the Greek. The next we find in 8:28. My text says, "We know that all things work together for good for those who love God." Another way that that can be translated, it's ambiguous in the Greek, is we know that God works all things together for good to them, for them who know the Lord, who love God. The sense here is that we know that all things co-work together. All things co-work. And that's why I prefer the translation that says, we know that God co-works all things together, because we're talking here about the work of God. Then we find the next occurrence in 8:29. My text reads, "For those whom God foreknew, God also predestined to be co-formed to the image of his Son." So here we get a bit of the sense, conformed, co-formed, formed with. And the last occurrence is in 8:32. And we read, "He who did not withhold his own Son, but gave him up for all of us, will he not with him," and that word in Greek is co-him, "will he not co-Christ, with Christ, also give us everything else?" So I'll write co-him and co-Christ, so we have the sense of what that means. Now, can you see a sense in the picture of this in English? This is what you get in Greek. These are all sons, though, in Greek. And that's the word that would be hitting our eyes over and over again as we read the Greek text. And now in English, I hope you can get the sense, visually at least, of all these codes that mount up, 10 of them, in 17 verses. And you can see also, I think, why the translators who translated our Bibles didn't go with translating these all co-words. I mean, it's awkward English. It's not graceful. It's not how we talk. But if I were translating Romans 8, I might want to do this, or it probably would, because it's not good English. But I would want to footnote all of these so that the reader would get the sense of all this co-stuff. So now that I've put that all up there, the next question is, what's so interesting and exciting about this? Yeah, Dottie?
I asked a question about the subject of each one of these. Is it always the same? Is it the Spirit and Christ? Is it the Spirit and mankind? Is it...
Okay, we can put that up there, too.
It does differ. It seemed to me that it was differing a little bit.
It does differ. Let's put that up, too. In 8:16, it's the Spirit co-witnessing with our spirit. So this is the Spirit. The next three are Christ. Co-heirs with Christ, co-sufferers with Christ, and co-glorified.
So that's humankind.
Subject is us.
Us?
Yes, us with Christ. You're right. So let's do us with Christ. Let's do it that way. And then it's the Spirit with us. Is that clarifying it?
Yeah.
Okay. Then we get down into 8:22, co-groaning, co-laboring. That's the creation, is the subject there.
With God?
Oh, are we the creation?
We're part of the creation.
So with God then, co-groaning, or who's growing with us? Or the rest of creation is growing with us?
Well, you see, I think that's how to read it. We're going to talk about this on Friday. But I do think that it's us with the creation. And
But the object isn't there.
The object isn't there. And but the reason, just for those of you who aren't going to be here on Friday, and I know some of you won't be, I'm interested in the rhetoric of how Paul sets this up. Going on in chapter 8, in verse 22, he has the creation co-groaning and co-laboring. And one of the issues that scholars have struggled with is, what does the creation mean? Does that mean everything except humans, so that we're separate from that? Or are we involved in that? It's ambiguous. But going on, we find that in verse 23, and not only the creation, but we ourselves are groaning. And Paul doesn't say we're laboring, but Paul says we ourselves are groaning. And so you get this sense that we are groaning with the creation and in labor with the creation. Going on even further, we find in verse, where the Spirit is groaning. In verse 26, my English translation doesn't use the word groan. It has the Spirit sighing, with sighs too deep for words. That word in Greek is the same. It's groaning again. The Spirit groans. So you get this sense of the creation groaning, us groaning with the creation, and the Spirit groaning too. So that's a big one. We'll look at that on Friday. Then, in 8:26, the Spirit co-helps us with our weakness. So the Spirit with us. Then, 8:28, God co-works all things. Then in
God with us.
And co-works. Yeah, God co-works all things.
It doesn't say how we're involved with that, but God is the one co-working.
But there has to be another if it's a co. It has to be God and...
Yeah.
And who?
Yeah. We don't know, but the thing I want to say about that is...
I'd like to know who else is involved.
The thing I'd like to say about that is...
Those who love God.
Yeah, it's that God works with. That's the thing.
Awesome. And see this one here. This translation says, "We know that all that happens to us is working for our good if we love God and are fitting to."
That's quite different, isn't it?
That's the Living Bible. It's the paraphrase thing.
Yeah. Well, you see again how translation shapes stuff. Yeah. Then we are co-formed to the image of God's Son. So we and the Son are co-formed. And then it's us with Christ receiving everything. So let's think about this. I will offer just a couple observations, and then I'd like us to talk about this. See if you can catch the spirit of this, too. The first thing I wanted to point out is that I think where these co-words come in the letter to the Romans is significant. It's significant that it comes at the point where we cease being described as slaves and where we speak. We cry, Abba. We have speech finally. And then these co-words cluster together and tumble out of Paul's mouth as he's dictating this letter. As we were talking about slavery in our Bible study on Monday, we talked about one of the characteristics of being a slave as being one on the margins of society, not a member of a community. As a slave, you are serving the members of the community, but you yourself are not a member. And part of that we talked about was speech. Slaves were not able to speak, and their silence kept them out of the community. Their silence kept them out. And so they had no community, no ability to speak. And that's where I think if we think about it with that material in mind, it's interesting the way Paul works this in this letter, that when we cease to be slaves in this book, when we have the ability to speak, Abba, then our community is formed. Then these co-words that bring us together with God, with Christ, and the Spirit just pile up to tell us how much community there can be now as we are children of God and given the gift, the gift of addressing God. Another aspect about slavery that's so fascinating for this is that I read a bunch of Greco-Roman literature last spring, and in it, it's stressed often that a slave was not able to cope. All these activities were excluded. Slaves did not have access to them in the Greco-Roman culture. And an example that I found, for instance, was in a play by Euripides. It's called Helen, and it's about Helen of Troy and her husband Menelaus. And in that play, a slave, a messenger, is talking to the two of them. And the slave is saying, Menelaus and Helen have just been reunited, and the slave is saying, I'm so happy for you. I want to co-feel, is the Greek word. I want to co-feel with you. I'm so happy for you. But because I'm a slave, I can't co-feel with you. So the way I will do it is I will make my heart, I will say that my heart is free. And in my heart, I will co-feel with you. This ability to co-feel, to be with someone else, was accessible only to free people, not to slaves. And so again, if you know that, the power of what Paul is doing here in Romans. We've been slaves, slaves to sin, slaves to God. But now we're children, we're heirs, we're free, we can speak. And so this ability to be in community and to co-feel, to co-be with one another and with God becomes ours. So those are the things I wanted to say about the placement of this and what that tells us about this whole thing of withness. The other thing I wanted to emphasize is the point that Tracy was bringing out. God is a God who works with. God is not a singular God up in heaven sending decrees down or acting down upon us without involving anyone or any of us. God is a God who works with. Even more than that, God is a God who works in witness. And this is where, this is an awkward English word. God works with. God works in witness. And another word that I've used for this is God works in collaboration. Chuck Hoff gave us a good 4th of July oration on collaboration, and that's the way God works. God would not approve of a tenure system that promotes only individual works. God works with. God works in withness. And one of the things that we pointed out in the early Bible study this morning is that this is just a complete contrast to the picture of God that we encountered in chapter 1 yesterday, where God is giving us over to our lusts and our passions and to our malice and greed and evil. That verb was used to talk about God's actions. God gave them over. God gave them over. We were going it alone. In contrast to that picture of God, here is God who works with us, with the Spirit, with Christ, and God who works in witness, in our collaborations with one another. Another way to say this, I think, that's important for us here at Holden and in our other communities is that God is a God of community, God who works in community. That is the nature of God and how God works, community. It's another way to put it, I think. So those were the observations I had about this. We've got about 5-7 minutes here before we... I have one more point I want to wrap up with. But what are your observations, or what's your experience of this?
Well, let me raise this question, if I may. What this all boils down to, does it not? Well, at least in verses 9 through 12. For example, you live as the Spirit tells you to, and so on. The Spirit of God lives in you. How do we set about today, this morning, out and decide, what is the Spirit telling me to do today? That's what this all boils down to.
Okay.
If we can get that communion, that understanding so ready when the Spirit is leading us, how do we know that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you're the teacher. You're supposed to know.
Well, I do have something to say. In fact, I guess what I'd want to say is that I think it's not always clear to us the way the Spirit is leading us or working with us. But the promise of God in this chapter of Romans that Paul is communicating so much, I think, is that even if we don't see it or know it, the promise is that God is working with us. And so we're called to trust that, to trust God's promise, that as we struggle together in community, as we struggle together to follow Christ, to follow the way the Spirit is leading us, God's promise is, I am there in your withness as you work with one another.
Well, I think that's really key, because I'm not sure that we can really discern the Spirit working in our lives by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're really called to be in community, that we hear God's voice through the community.
But pardon me for interrupting, but we also have another voice called our human nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Has been explained here.
Yeah.
So we got a problem deciding which ear, what's coming in which ear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the real problem.
Mm-hmm. It is.
That's what all this boils down to.
Yep. No,
so
I absolutely
give us some clues now as to which one I'm supposed to pay attention to.
But I think it gets back to your point again that by ourselves it's very hard to hear and to distinguish the voice of sin from the voice of the Spirit, for instance. But that's where, in community, in worship, in our lives together, we are called to be witness and to be witnesses to one another and to be accountable to one another. It's one of the hard tasks of community, I think, to call each other to account so that we can together discern the way. On our own, I think we can't. That's what I think Paul is saying. Yeah.
This is really very interesting. And in relationship, in light of that question, I wondered to what extent the sense of what God's will is has to do with offering, you know, with what we do, always being in relationship to this dynamic. The sense that we are all interrelated, that what I do will have an impact. If I take everything in the dish, it won't be there for somebody else. And that living in Christ in a way has to do with living very much an awareness of our interrelatedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That points so well to material we'll look at on Saturday, where Paul gets more into, the outline isn't up there anymore and I'm pointing to it, but to the implications of all this for how we live. And one of the concepts that he develops in chapters 12 and following is this sense of upbuilding the neighbor. That's part of our withness, the part of the way God works. And what we're called to be is for the neighbor, Not for me, you know. And that, so that ties in really well. So come on Saturday if you're around. And-